scream, the Times rather sensationally called it, there appears to be a small rip in the galaxy. What does that mean? Dennis asked. It seems to mean that several stars have vanished. Vanished where? That's the odd part. Vanished. Completely. Where the stars were, there is, as far as our instruments can detect, nothing. Your father was out in California several weeks ago, you remember, at Mount Palomar. But things can't just vanish, Sandy said. We had it in school, the balance of matter. Their mother added, very quietly, it seems to be getting unbalanced. You mean like the ecology? No. I mean that matter actually seems to be being annihilated. Dennis said flatly, but that's impossible. E equals mc squared, Sandy said. Matter can be converted into energy and energy into matter. You have to have one or the other. Mrs. Murray said, thus far, Einstein's law has never been disproved. But it's coming into question. Nothingness? Dennis said. That's impossible. One would hope so. And that's what Father's going off about? Yes, to consult with several other scientists, Shasti from India, Shen Shu from China, you've heard of them. Outside the dining room windows came a sudden brilliant flash of light, followed by a loud clap of thunder. The windows rattled. The kitchen door burst open. Everybody jumped. Meg sprang up, crying nervously, "Oh, Mother!" Sit down, Meg. You've heard thunder before. You're sure it's not one of those cosmic things? Sandy shut the door. Mrs. Murray was calmly reassuring. Positive. They're completely inaudible to human ears. Lightning flashed again. Thunder boomed. As a matter of fact, there are only two instruments in the world delicate enough to pick up the sound, which is incredibly high-pitched. It's perfectly possible that it's been going on for millennia, and only now our instruments are capable of recording it. Birds can hear sounds way above our normal pitch, Sandy said. I mean, way up the scale that we can't hear at all. Birds can't hear this. Dennis said, I wonder if snakes can hear as high a pitch as birds. Snakes don't have ears, Sandy contradicted. So they feel vibrations and sound waves. I think Louise hears all kinds of things out of human range. What's for dessert? Meg's voice was still tense. We don't usually have thunderstorms in October. Please calm down, Meg, Mrs. Murray started clearing the table. If you'll stop and think, you'll remember that we've had an unseasonable storm for every month in the year. Sandy said, why does Meg always exaggerate everything? Why does she have to be so cosmic? What's for dessert? I don't, Meg started defensively, then jumped as the rain began to pelt against the windows. There's some ice cream in the freezer, Mrs. Murray said. Sorry, I haven't been thinking about desserts. Meg's supposed to make desserts, Dennis said. Not that we expect pies or anything, Meg, but even you can't go too wrong with Jell-O. Charles Wallace caught Meg's eye, and she closed her mouth. He put his hand in the pocket of his robe again, though this time he did not produce the feather, and gave her a small private smile. He may have been thinking about his dragons, but he had also been listening carefully, both to the conversation and to the storm, his fair head tilted slightly to one side. This ripping in the galaxy, Mother, does it have any effect on our own solar system? That, Mrs. Murray replied, is what we would all like to know. Sandy brushed this aside impatiently. It's all much too complicated for me. I'm sure banking is a lot simpler. And more lucrative, Dennis added. The windows shook in the wind. The twins looked through the darkness at the slashing rain. It's a good thing we brought in so much stuff from the garden before dinner. This is almost hail, Meg asked nervously. Is it dangerous, this ripping in the sky or whatever it is? Meg, we really know nothing about it. It may have been going on all along, and we only now have the instruments to record it. Like ferandoli, Charles Wallace said. We tend to think things are new because we've just discovered them. But is it dangerous? Meg repeated. Meg, we don't know enough about it yet. That's why it's important that your father and some of the other physicists get together at once. But it could be dangerous? Anything can be dangerous. Meg looked down at the remains of her dinner. Dragons and rips in the sky. Louise and Fortinbras greeting something large and strange. Charles Wallace pale and listless. She did not like any of it. I'll do the dishes, she told her mother. They cleaned up the kitchen in silence. Mrs. Murray had sent the reluctant twins to practice for the school orchestra, Dennis on the flute, which he played well, accompanied by Sandy less skillfully on the piano. But it was a pleasant, familiar noise, and Meg relaxed into it. When the dishwasher was humming, the pots and pans polished and hung on their hooks, she went up to her attic bedroom to do her homework. This room was supposed to be her own private place, and it would have been perfect except for the fact that it was seldom really private. The twins kept their electric trains in the big open section of the attic. The ping-pong table was there, and anything anybody didn't want around downstairs but didn't want to throw away. Although Meg's room was at the far end of the attic, it was easily available to the twins when they needed help with their math homework. And Charles Wallace always knew, without being told, when she was troubled, and would come up to the attic to sit on the foot of her bed. The only time she didn't want Charles Wallace was when he himself was what was troubling her. She did not want him now. Rain was still spattering against her window, but with diminishing force. The wind was swinging around from the south to the west. The storm was passing and the temperature falling. Her room was cold, but she did not plug in the little electric heater her parents had given her to supplement the inadequate heat which came up the attic stairs. Instead, she shoved her books aside and tiptoed back downstairs, stepping carefully over the seventh stair, which not only creaked but sometimes gave off a report like a shot. The twins were still practicing. Her mother was in the living room in front of the fire reading to Charles Wallace, not from books about trains or animals, which the twins had liked at that age, but from a scientific magazine. An article called The Polarizabilities and Hyperpolarizabilities of Small Molecules by the theoretical chemist Peter Liebman. Ouch, Meg thought ruefully. This kind of thing is Charles Wallace's bedtime reading, and our parents expect him to go to first grade and not get into trouble? Charles Wallace lay on the floor in front of the fire, staring into the flames, half listening, half brooding, his head as usual pillowed on Fortinbras' comfortable bulk. Meg would have liked to take Fort with her, but that would mean letting the family know she was going out. She hurried as quickly and silently as possible through the kitchen and out into the pantry. As she pulled, the kitchen door closed behind her, slowly, carefully, so nobody would hear. The pantry door flew open with a bang, and the door to her mother's lab on the left slammed shut in a gust of wind. She stopped, listened, waited for one of the twins to open the kitchen door and see what was going on. But nothing happened except that the wind blew wildly through the pantry. She shivered and grabbed the first rain clothes that came to hand. A big black rubber poncho that belonged to the twins and had done double duty as a ground cloth for a tent, and Charles Wallace's yellow sou'wester. Then she took the big flashlight from the hook, shut the pantry door firmly behind her, and ran across the lawn, tripping over the croquet wicket. Limping, she crossed the patch of dandelion, burdock, and milkweed that was growing up in the opening the twins had cut in the Barbary fence. Once she was in the vegetable garden, she hoped that she would be invisible to anybody chancing to look out a window. She could imagine Sandy or Dennis's reaction if they asked her where she was going and she told them she was looking for dragons. Why, in fact, had she come out? And what was she looking for? Was it dragons? Fortinbras and Louise both had seen, and not been afraid of, something. Something which had left the feathers and scales. And that something or somethings was likely to be uncomfortable in the wet pasture. If it or they came to seek shelter in the house, she wanted to be prepared. Not only for dragons, in which she did not quite believe, despite her faith in Charles Wallace and the feather with the peculiar rachis, but also for Louise the Larger. The twins insisted that Louise was an unusual snake, but this afternoon was the first time Meg had seen any signs that Louise was anything more than a contented, common, garden-variety snake. Meg checked the shadows on the wall, but there was no sign of Louise, so she lingered, not at all anxious to cross the apple orchard and go into the north pasture to the two glacial rocks. For a few minutes she would stay in the homely garden and gather her courage and be safe from discovery. The twins were hardly likely to come out after dark in the cold and wet to admire the last few cabbages, or the vine which had borne their prize cucumber the size of a vegetable marrow. The garden was bordered on the east by two rows of sunflowers which stood with their heavy fringed heads bowed over so that they looked like a huddle of witches. Meg glanced at them nervously. Raindrops dripped from their faces with melancholy unconcern, but no longer from the sky. There was a hint of light from the full moon behind the thinning clouds, turning all the vegetables into beings strange and unreal. The gaping rows where once beans had stood and lettuce and peas had a forlorn look. There was an air of sadness and confusion about the carefully planned pattern. "Like everything else," Meg spoke to the few remaining cauliflower heads, "it's falling apart. It's not right in the United States of America that a little kid shouldn't be safe in school." She moved slowly along the orchard wall. The cidery smell of fallen apples was cut by the wind, which had completely changed course and was now streaming across the garden from the northwest, sharp and glittery with frost. She saw a shadow move on the wall and jumped back. Louise the Larger. It must be Louise. And Meg could not climb that wall or cross the orchard to the north pasture until she was sure that neither Louise nor the not-quite-seen shape was lurking there waiting to pounce on her. Her legs felt watery, so she sat on a large squat pumpkin to wait. The cold wind brushed her cheek. Corn tassels hissed like ocean waves. She looked warily about. She was seeing, she realized, through lenses streaked and spattered by raindrops blowing from sunflowers and corn. So she took off her spectacles, felt under the poncho for her kilt, and wiped them. Better, though the world was still a little wavery, as though seen underwater. She listened, listened. In the orchard she heard the soft plomp of falling apples, wind shaking the trees, branches rustling. She peered through the darkness. Something was moving, coming closer. Snakes never come out in the cold and dark. She knew that. Nevertheless, Louise. Yes, it was the big snake. She emerged from the rocks of the stone wall, slowly, warily, watchfully. Meg's heart was thumping, although Louise was not threatening. At least, Louise was not threatening her. But Louise was waiting. And this time there was no welcome in the waiting. Meg looked in fascination as the head of the snake slowly weaved back and forth, then quivered in recognition. Behind Meg, a voice came. "Margaret." She whirled around. It was Mr. Jenkins. She looked at him in complete bewilderment. He said, "Your little brother thought I might find you here, Margaret." Yes, Charles would guess, would know where she was. But why would Mr. Jenkins have been speaking to Charles Wallace? The principal had never been to the Murray's house, or any parents for that matter. All confrontations were in the safe anonymity of his office. Why would he come through the wet grass in the still-dripping garden to look for her instead of sending one of the twins? He said, "I wanted to come find you myself, Margaret, because I feel that I owe you an apology for my sharpness with you last week when you came to see me." He held out a hand, pale in the moonlight wavering behind the clouds. In utter confusion, she reached out to take his hand, and as she did so, Louise rose up on the wall behind her, hissing and making a strange, warning clacking. Meg turned to see the snake, looking as large and hooded as a cobra, hissing angrily at Mr. Jenkins, raising her large, dark coils to strike. Mr. Jenkins screamed in a way that she had never known a man could scream, a high, piercing screech. Then he rose up into the night like a great flapping bird, flew, screaming across the sky, became a rent, an emptiness, a slash of nothingness. Meg found that she, too, was screaming. It could not have happened. There was no one, no thing there. She thought she saw Louise slithering back through a dark recess in the stone wall, disappearing. It was impossible. Her mind had snapped. It was some kind of hallucination caused by the weather, by her anxiety, by the state of the world. A thick, ugly smell like spoiled cabbage, like flower stalks left too long in water, rose like a miasma from the place where Mr. Jenkins had been. But he could not have been there. She screamed again in uncontrollable panic as a tall shape hurtled towards her. Calvin. Calvin O'Keefe. She burst into hysterical tears of relief. He vaulted over the wall to her, his strong, thin arms tight around her, holding her. Meg. Meg, what is it? She could not control her terrified sobbing. Meg, what's the matter? What's happened? He shook her urgently. Gasping, she tried to tell him. I know it sounds incredible, she finished. She was still trembling violently, her heart racing. When he did not speak, but continued soothingly to pat her back, she said through a few final hiccuping sobs, Oh, Calvin, I wish I had imagined it. Do you think maybe I did? I don't know, Calvin said flatly. He continued to hold her strongly, comfortingly. Now that Calvin was here, would take over, she was able to manage a slightly hysterical giggle. Mr. Jenkins always said I have too much imagination, but it's never been that kind of imagination. I've never hallucinated or anything, have I? No. He replied firmly. You have not. What's that awful stench? I don't know. It's not nearly as bad now as it was just before you came. It makes silage smell like roses. Ugh. Calvin, Louise the Larger. It's not the first time today Louise has done something peculiar. What? She told him about Louise that afternoon. But she wasn't attacking or anything then. She was still friendly. She's always been a friendly snake. She let her breath out in a long, quavering sigh. Cal, let me have your handkerchief, please. My glasses are filthy and I can't see a thing, and right now I'd like to be able to see what's going on. My handkerchief is filthy, but Calvin fished in his pockets. It's better than a kilt. Meg spat on her glasses and wiped them. Without their aid, she could see no more of the older boy than a vague blur, so she made bold to say, Oh, Cal, I was hoping you might come over tonight anyhow. I'm surprised you're even willing to speak to me. I came over to apologize for what my brother did to Charles Wallace. Meg adjusted her spectacles with her usual rough shove up the nose, just as a shaft of moonlight broke through the clouds and illuminated Calvin's troubled expression. She returned his handkerchief. It wasn't your fault. Then, I must have had a mental aberration or something about Louise and Mr. Jenkins, mustn't I? I don't know, Meg. You've never had a mental aberration before, have you? Well, not that I know of. Few mits to Mr. Jenkins, anyhow. She almost shouted, What did you say? Fumits to Mr. Jenkins. Fumits is my new swear word. I'm tired of all the old ones. Fumits are dragon droppings, and I know fumits are dragon droppings. What I want to know is why you picked on fumits of all things. Well, it seemed quite a reasonable choice to me. Suddenly she was shaking again. Calvin,
Please, don't. It's too serious. He dropped his bantering tone. Okay, Meg, what's up about Fumitz?
Oh, Cal, I was so sort of shook about the Mr. Jenkins thing, I almost forgot about the dragons.
The what? She told him all about Charles Wallace and his dragons. And he's never hallucinated before either. She told him again about Louise greeting the shadow of something they had not quite seen. But it certainly wasn't Mr. Jenkins. Louise wasn't in the least friendly about Mr. Jenkins.
It's wild, Calvin said. Absolutely wild.
But we did see Fumitz, Calvin, or something, more like feathers, really, but not like real feathers. Charles Wallace took one home. There was a whole pile of them. These sort of feathers and dragon scales by the biggest rock in the north pasture. Calvin sprang to his feet. Let's go, then. Bring your flashlight. It was possible now for her to cross the orchard and go into the pasture with Calvin to take the lead. Uppermost in Meg's mind, superseding fear, was the need to prove that she and Charles Wallace weren't just making something up, that the wild tales she had told Calvin were real. Not Mr. Jenkins turning into a flying emptiness in the sky. She did not want that to be real, but the dragons. For if nothing that had happened touched on reality, then she was going out of her mind. When they reached the pasture, Calvin took the light from her. I'll go ahead a bit. But Meg followed close on his heels. She thought she could sense disbelief as he swept the arc of light around the base of the rock. The beam came to rest in a small circle, and in the center of the circle shone something gold and glittering.
Phew, Calvin said.
Meg giggled with relief and tension. Don't you mean Fumitz?
Has anybody ever seen a Fumit?
Calvin was down on hands and knees, running his fingers through the little pile of feathers and scales. Okay, this is most peculiar.
But what left it?
After all, a gang of dragons just doesn't disappear. A drive of dragons, Meg corrected automatically. Do you really think it's dragons? Calvin did not answer. He asked, Did you tell your mother? Charles Wallace showed the feather to the twins during dinner, and Mother saw it too. The twins said it wasn't a bird's feather because the rachis isn't right, and then the conversation got shifted. I think Charles shifted it on purpose. How is he? Calvin asked. How badly did Whippy hurt him? He's been hurt worse. Mother put compresses on his eye, and it's turning black and blue, but that's about all. She was not ready yet to mention his pallor or shortness of wind. You'd think we lived in the roughest section of an inner city or something instead of way out in the peaceful country. There isn't a day he doesn't get shoved around by one of the bigger kids. It's not only Whippy. Cal, why is it that my parents know all about physics and biology and stuff and nothing about keeping their son from being mugged? Calvin pulled himself up onto the smaller of the two stones. If it's any consolation to you, Meg, I doubt if my parents know the difference between physics and biology. Maybe Charles would be better off in a city school where there are lots of different kinds of kids, white, black, yellow, Spanish-speaking, rich, poor. Maybe he wouldn't stand out as being so different if there were other different people, too. Here, well, everybody's sort of alike. People are kind of proud of having your parents live here in Pally with the president and all, but you Murrays certainly aren't like anybody else. You've managed. Same way the twins have. Playing by the laws of the jungle, you know that. Anyhow, my parents and grandparents were born right here in the village, and so were my great-grandparents. The O'Keefes may be shiftless, but at least they're not newcomers. His voice deepened with an old sadness. Oh, Cal. He shrugged his dark mood aside. I think maybe we'd better go talk to your mother.
Not yet.
Charles Wallace's voice came from behind them. She's got enough worries. Let's wait till the dragons come back. Meg jumped.
Charles, why aren't you in bed? Does Mother know you're out?
I was in bed. Mother doesn't know I'm out, obviously. Meg was near tears of exhaustion. Nothing is obvious anymore. And then in her big sister tone of voice, you shouldn't be out this late. What happened? What do you mean? Meg, I came out because something frightened you. He sighed, a strangely tired and ancient sigh from so small a boy. I was almost asleep, and I felt you screaming. I don't want to tell you about it. I don't want it to have happened. Where's Fortinbras? I left him at home and told him not to let on that I wasn't sound asleep in bed. I didn't want him tangling with dragons. Meg, what happened? You've got to tell me. Meg said, Okay, Charles, I don't doubt your dragons anymore. No dragons could be more incredible than Mr. Jenkins coming to look for me in the garden and then turning into a great shrieking bird of nothingness. She spoke quickly because what she was saying sounded so absurd. Charles Wallace did not laugh. He opened his mouth to speak, then swung around. Who's here? Nobody, Calvin said. Meg and me? You? But he jumped down from the rock. There's somebody else. Near. Meg moved closer to Calvin. Her heart, it seemed, stopped beating. Hush, Charles Wallace said, though they had not spoken. He listened with lifted head, like Fortinbras catching a scent. To the right of the pasture was a woods, a small forest of oak, maple, beech, stripped of all but a few brittle leaves, backed by the dark winter richness of assorted spruce and pine. The ground, which the moonlight did not reach, was covered with fallen damp leaves and pine needles which would silence footsteps. Then they heard the sharp crack of a breaking twig. Meg and Calvin, straining to peer through the trees, saw nothing. Then Charles Wallace cried, My dragons! They turned around and they saw, there by the great rock, wings. It seemed like hundreds of wings spreading, folding, stretching. And eyes. How many eyes can a drive of dragons have? And small jets of flame. Suddenly a voice called to them from the direction of the woods. Do not be afraid. Chapter 3. The Man in the Night. A huge dark form strode swiftly through the woods and into the pasture. It reached them in a few strides, and then stood very still, so that the folds of the long robe seemed chiseled out of granite. Do not be afraid, he repeated. He won't hurt you. He? Yes, Charles Wallace's drive of dragons was a single creature, although Meg was not at all surprised that Charles Wallace had confused this fierce, wild being with dragons. She had the feeling that she never saw all of it at once, and which of all the eyes could she meet? Merry eyes, wise eyes, ferocious eyes, kitten eyes, dragon eyes, opening and closing, looking at her, looking at Charles Wallace and Calvin and the strange tall man. And wings, wings in constant motion, covering and uncovering the eyes. When the wings were spread out, they had a span of at least 10 feet, and when they were all folded in, the creature resembled a misty, feathery sphere. Little spurts of flame and smoke spouted up between the wings. It could certainly start a grass fire if it weren't careful. Meg did not wonder that Charles Wallace had not approached it. Again the tall stranger reassured them. He won't hurt you. The stranger was dark, dark as night and tall as a tree, and there was something in the repose of his body, the quiet of his voice, which drove away fear. Charles Wallace stepped towards him. Who are you? A teacher. Charles Wallace's sigh was longing. I wish you were my teacher. I am. The cello-like voice was calm, slightly amused. Charles Wallace advanced another step. And my dragons? The tall man, the teacher, held out his hand in the direction of the wild creature, which seemed to gather itself together to rise up to give a great courteous bow to all of them. The teacher said, His name is Progonoscus. Charles Wallace said, He? Yes. He's not dragons? He is a cherubim.
What?
A cherubim. Flame spurted skywards in indignation at the doubt in the atmosphere. Great wings raised and spread, and the children were looked at by a great many eyes. When the wild thing spoke, it was not in vocal words, but directly into their minds.
"I suppose you think I ought to be a golden-haired baby face with no body and two useless little wings?"
Charles Wallace stared at the great creature. "It might be simpler if you were." Meg pulled her poncho closer about her for protection in case the cherubim spouted fire in her direction.
"It is a constant amazement to me," the cherubim thought at them, "that so many earthling artists paint cherubim to resemble baby pigs."
Calvin made a sound which, if he had been less astonished, would have been a laugh. "But cherubim is plural." The fire-spouting beast returned.
"I am practically plural. The little boy thought I was a tribe of dragons, didn't he? I am certainly not a cherub. I am a singular cherubim."
"What are you doing here?" Charles Wallace asked.
"I was sent."
"Sent?"
"To be in your class. I don't know what I've done to be assigned to a class with such immature earthlings. I have a hard enough job as it is. I really don't fancy coming back to school at all at my age."
"How old are you?" Meg held her poncho out wide, ready to use it as a shield.
"Age for cherubim is immaterial. It's only for time-bound creatures that age even exists. I am, in cherubic terms, still a child, and that is all you need to know. It's very rude to ask questions about age."
Two of the wings crossed and uncrossed. The message had been rueful rather than annoyed. Charles Wallace spoke to the tall man.
"You are my teacher? And his teacher, too?"
"I am."
Charles Wallace looked up at the strange dark face, which was stern and gentle at the same time.
"It's too good to be true. I think I must be having a dream. I wish I'd just go on dreaming and not wake up."
"What is real?" The teacher stretched out an arm and gently touched the bruise on Charles Wallace's cheek, the puffed and discolored flesh under his eye.
"You are awake."
"Or if you're asleep," Meg said. "We're all having the same dream. Aren't we, Calvin?" "The thing that makes me think we're awake is that if I were to dream about a cherubim, it wouldn't look like that. That." Several very blue, long-lashed eyes looked directly at Calvin.
"Progenoscus, as the teacher told you. Progenoscus. And don't get any ideas about calling me Cherry or Cheery or Bimmy."
"It would be easier," Charles Wallace said, but the creature repeated firmly,
"Progenoscus."
Out of the dark form of the teacher came a deep, gentle rumbling of amusement, a rumbling which expanded and rose and bubbled into a great laugh.
"All right, then, my children, are you ready to start? We will call it, for want of a better word in your language, school. Are you ready to start school?"
Charles Wallace, a small and rather ludicrous figure in the yellow slicker he had pulled on over his pajamas, looked up at the oak tree height and strength of the teacher.
"The sooner the better. Time's running out."
"Hey, wait a minute," Calvin objected. "What are you going to do with Charles? You and the cherubim can't take him off without consulting his parents."
"What makes you think I'm planning to?" The teacher gave an easy little jump, and there he was, comfortably sitting on the tallest of the glacial rocks as though it were a stool, his arms loosely about his knees, the folds of his robe blending with the moonlit stone.
"And I came not only to call Charles Wallace. I came to call all three of you."
Meg looked startled.
"All of us? But..."
"You may address me as Belogeny," the teacher said.
Charles Wallace asked, "Mr. Belogeny? Dr. Belogeny? Sir Belogeny?"
"Belogeny is enough. That is all of my name you need to know. Are you ready?"
Meg still looked astonished.
"Calvin and me too?"
"Yes."
"But..."
As always when she felt unsure, Meg was argumentative.
"Calvin doesn't need... He's the best student in school, and the best athlete. He's important and everything. And I'm getting along now. It's Charles who's the trouble. You can see for yourself. School, ordinary school, is just not going to work out for him."
Blogeny's voice was cool. That is hardly my problem.
Then why are you here?
That Blajini might have been sent solely to help her brother did not seem at all astonishing to Meg. Again came the rumble that bubbled up into a laugh.
My dears, you must not take yourselves so seriously. Why should school be easy for Charles Wallace?
Well, it shouldn't be this bad. This is the United States of America. They'll hurt him if somebody doesn't do something.
He will have to learn to defend himself.
Charles Wallace, looking very small and defenseless, spoke quietly.
The teacher is right. It's a question of learning to adapt, and nobody can do that for me.
If everybody will leave me alone and stop trying to help me, I'll learn, eventually, how not to be conspicuous. I can assure you I haven't mentioned mitochondrion ferandoli lately.
The teacher nodded grave approval. Charles Wallace moved closer to him.
I'm very glad you haven't come because I'm making such a mess of school.
But,
Blajini, if you haven't come because of that, then why are you here?
I have come not so much to offer you my help as to ask for yours.
Ours? Meg asked.
Charles Wallace looked up at the teacher.
I'm not much of a help to anybody right now. It isn't just that I'm not getting along at school.
Yes, Blajini said. I know of the other problem. Nevertheless, you are called, and anybody who is invited to study with one of the teachers is called because he is needed. You have talents we cannot afford to lose. Then, we must find out what is making you ill and, if possible, make you well again.
If possible? Meg asked anxiously.
Calvin asked sharply, Charles? Ill? What's wrong? What's the matter with Charles?
Look at him, Meg said in a low voice. Look how pale he is, and he has trouble breathing. He got out of breath just walking across the orchard.
She turned to the teacher.
Oh, please, please, Blajini, can you help?
Blajini looked down at her darkly, quietly.
I think, my child, that it is you who must help.
Me?
Yes.
You know I'd do anything in the world to help Charles.
Calvin looked questioningly at the teacher.
Yes, Calvin, you too.
How? How can we help?
You will learn as the lessons progress.
Calvin asked, Where are we going to have these lessons, then? Where's your school? Blajini jumped lightly down from the rock. Despite his height and girth, he moved, Meg thought, as though he were used to a heavier gravity than Earth's. He strode lightly halfway across the pasture to where there was a large, flat rock where the children often went with their parents to watch the stars. He dropped down onto the rock and lay stretched out on his back, gesturing to the others to join him. Meg lay beside him, with Calvin on her other side, so that she felt protected, not only from the cold night wind, but from the cherubim, who had reached the rock with the beat of a wing and assorted himself into an assemblage of wings and eyes and puffs of smoke at a discreet distance from Charles Wallace, who was on Blajini's other side.
It's all right, dragons, Charles Wallace said. I'm not afraid of you.
The cherubim rearranged his wings.
Proganoscus, please.
Blajini looked up at the sky, raised his arm, and made a wide, embracing gesture. The clouds had almost dispersed. Only a few rapidly flying streamers veiled the stars, which blazed with the fierce brilliance of the rapidly plummeting Mercury. The teacher's sweeping motion indicated the entire sparkling stretch of sky. Then he sat up and folded his arms across his chest, and his strange luminous eyes turned inwards, so that he was looking not at the stars nor at the children, but into some deep, dark place far within himself, and then further. He sat there, moving in, deeper and deeper, for time out of time. Then the focus of his eyes returned to the children, and he gave his radiant smile and answered Calvin's question as though not a moment had passed.
Where is my school? Here, there, everywhere.
In the schoolyard during first grade recess, with the cherubim and seraphim, among the farandoli?
Charles Wallace exclaimed, "My mother's isolated the farandoli."
So she has.
Blagini, do you know if something's wrong with my farandoli and mitochondria?
Blagini replied quietly, "Your mother and Dr. Kalubra are trying to find that out."
"Well then, what do we do now?"
"Go home to bed."
"But school?"
"You will all go to school as usual in the morning." It was total anticlimax.
"But your school?" Meg cried in disappointment. She had hoped that Charles Wallace would never have to enter the old red school building again, that Blagini would take over, make everything all right.
"My children," Blagini said gravely, "my school building is the entire cosmos. Before your time with me is over, I may have to take you great distances and to very strange places."
"Are we your whole class?" Calvin asked. "Meg and Charles Wallace and me?"
Progonoscus let out a puff of huffy smoke. "Sorry, and the cherubim?" Blagini said, "Wait. You will know when the time comes."
"And why on earth is one of our classmates a cherubim?" Meg said. "Sorry, Progonoscus, but it does seem very insulting to you to have to be with mortals like us."
Progonoscus batted several eyes in apology.
"I didn't mean what I said about immature earthlings. If we have been sent to the same teacher, then we have things to learn from each other. A cherubim is not a higher order than earthlings, you know, just different."
Blagini nodded. "Yes, you have much to learn from each other. Meanwhile, I will give each of you assignments. Charles Wallace, can you guess what yours is?"
"To learn to adapt."
"I don't want you to change," Meg cried.
"Neither do I," Blagini replied. "Charles Wallace's problem is to learn to adapt while remaining wholly himself."
"What's my assignment, Blagini?" Meg asked.
The teacher frowned briefly in thought. Then, "I am trying to put it into Earth terms, terms which you will understand. You must pass 3 tests, or trials. You must start immediately on the first one."
"What is it?"
"Part of the trial is that you must discover for yourself what it is."
"But how?"
"That I cannot tell you. But you will not be alone. Progonoscus is to work with you. You will be what I think you would call partners. Together, you must pass the 3 tests."
"But suppose we fail?"
Progonoscus flung several wings over his eyes in horror at the thought. Blagini said quietly, "It is a possibility, but I would prefer you not to suppose any such thing. Remember that these 3 trials will be nothing you could imagine or expect right now."
"But Blagini, I can hardly take a cherubim to school with me."
Blagini looked affectionately at the great creature, whose wings were still folded protectingly about himself. "That is for the 2 of you to decide. He is not always visible, you know. Myself, I find him a little simpler when he's just a wind or a flame, but he was convinced he'd be more reassuring to earthlings if he enfleshed himself." Charles Wallace reached out and slipped his hand into the teacher's.
"If I could take him just this way, looking like a drive of dragons, into the schoolyard with me, I bet I wouldn't have any trouble."
Meg said, "Didn't you tell me you were supposed to bring a pet to school tomorrow?" Charles Wallace laughed. "We may bring a small pet tomorrow to share with the class." Progonoscus peered under one wing.
"I am not a joking matter."
"Oh, Progo," Meg assured him. "It's only whistling in the dark." Charles Wallace, still holding the teacher's hand, asked him,
"Will you come home with us now and meet my mother?"
"Not tonight, Charles. It is very late for you to be up, and who knows what tomorrow will bring."
"Don't you know?"
"I am only a teacher, and I would not arrange the future ahead of time if I could."
"Come." I will walk part of the way back to the house with you. Meg asked, What about Progonoscus? The cherubim replied, If it is not the time for Blarjany to meet your family, it is hardly the time for me. I am quite comfortable here. Perhaps you could come meet me early tomorrow morning and we can compare our night thoughts.
Well, okay. I guess that's best. Good night, then.
Good night, Megling. He waved a wing at her, then folded himself up into a great puff. No eyes showed. No flame, no smoke. Meg shivered. Blarjany asked, Are you cold? She shivered again. That thunderstorm before dinner. I suppose it was caused by a cold front meeting a warm front, but it did seem awfully cosmic. I never expected to meet a cherubim.
Blarjany, Calvin said, you haven't given me an assignment.
No, my son. There is work for you, difficult work, and dangerous. But I cannot tell you yet what it is. Your assignment is to wait, without question. Please come to the Murray's house after school tomorrow. You are free to do that?
Oh, sure, Calvin said. I can skip my after-school stuff for once.
Good. Until then, now let us go. Charles Wallace led the way with Meg and Calvin close behind. The wind was blowing out of the northwest, colder, it seemed, with each gust. When they reached the stone wall to the apple orchard, the moon was shining clearly with that extraordinary brightness which makes light and dark acute and separate. Some apples still clung to their branches, a few as dark as Blarjany, others shining with a silvery light, almost as though they were illuminated from within. On top of the pale stones of the wall lay a dark shadow which was moving slowly, sinuously. It rose up, carefully uncoiling, seeming to spread a hood as it loomed over them. Its forked tongue flickered, catching the light, and a hissing issued from its mouth.
Louise.
But this was not the threatening Louise who had hissed and clacked at the impossible Mr. Jenkins. This was the Louise Meg and Charles Wallace had seen that afternoon. The Louise who had been waiting to greet the unknown shadow. The shadow who, Meg suddenly understood, must have been Blarjany. Nevertheless, she pressed closer to Calvin. She had never felt very secure around Louise, and the snake's strange behavior that afternoon and evening made her seem even more alien than when she was only the twins' pet. Now Louise was weaving slowly back and forth in a gentle rhythm, almost as though she were making a serpentine version of a deep curtsy. And the sibilant sound was a gentle, treble fluting. Blarjany bowed to the snake. Louise most definitely returned the bow. Blarjany explained gravely, She is a colleague of mine.
But, hey now, Calvin sputtered. Wait a minute.
She is a teacher. That is why she is so fond of the two boys, Sandy and Dennis. One day they will be teachers too.
Meg said, They're going to be successful businessmen and support the rest of us in the way to which we are not accustomed.
Blarjany waved this aside. They will be teachers. It is a high calling, and you must not be distressed that it is not yours. You, too, have a work. Louise, with a last burst of her tiny, strange melody, dropped back to the wall and disappeared among the stones.
Perhaps we're dreaming after all, Calvin said wonderingly.
What is real? The teacher asked again. I will say good night to you now.
Charles Wallace was reluctant to leave. We won't wake up in the morning and find it all never happened. We won't wake up and find we dreamed everything.
If only one of us does, Meg said, and nobody else remembers any of it, then it's a dream. But if we all wake up remembering, then it really happened.
Wait until tomorrow to find what tomorrow holds, Blarjany advised. Good night, my children.
They did not ask him where he was going to spend the night, though Meg wondered, because it was the kind of presumptuous question one could not possibly ask Blarjany. They left him standing and watching after them, the folds of his robes chiseled like granite, his dark face catching and refracting the moonlight like fused glass.
They crossed the orchard and garden and entered the house, as usual, by the back way, through the pantry. The door to the lab was open and the lights on. Mrs. Murray was bent over her microscope, and Dr. Calubra was curled up in an old red leather chair reading. The lab was a long, narrow room with great slabs of stone for the floor. It had originally been used to keep milk and butter and other perishables, long before the days of refrigerators, and it was still difficult to heat in winter. The long work counter with the stone sink at one end was ideal for Mrs. Murray's lab equipment. In one corner were two comfortable chairs and a reading lamp, which softened the clinical glare of the lights over the counter. But Meg could not think of a time when she had seen her mother relaxing in one of those chairs. She inevitably perched on one of the lab stools. She looked up from the strange convolutions of the microelectron microscope.
"Charles, what are you doing out of bed?"
"I woke up," Charles Wallace said blandly. "I knew Meg and Calvin were outside, so I went to get them." Mrs. Murray glanced sharply at her son, then greeted Calvin warmly. Charles Wallace asked, "Is it okay if we make some cocoa?"
"It's very late for you to be up, Charles, and tomorrow's a school day."
"It'll help me get back to sleep." Mrs. Murray seemed about to refuse, but Dr. Calubra closed her book, saying,
"Why not, for once? Let Charles have a nap when he gets home in the afternoon. I'd like some cocoa myself. Let's make it out here while your mother goes on with her work. I'll do it."
"I'll get the milk and stuff from the kitchen," Meg said. With Dr. Louise present, they were not, she felt, free to talk to their mother about the events of the evening. The children were all fond of Dr. Louise and trusted her completely as a physician, but they were not quite sure that she had their parents' capacity to accept the extraordinary. Almost sure, but not quite. Dr. Calubra had a good deal in common with their parents. She, too, had given up work which paid extremely well in both money and prestige, to come live in this small rural village. "Too many of my colleagues have forgotten that they are supposed to practice the art of healing. If I don't have the gift of healing in my hands, then all my expensive training isn't worth very much." She, too, had turned her back on the glitter of worldly success. Meg knew that her parents, despite the fact that they were consulted by the President of the United States, had given up much when they moved to the country in order to devote their lives to pure research. Their discoveries, many of them made in this stone laboratory, had made the Murrays more, rather than less, open to the strange, to the mysterious, to the unexplainable. Dr. Calubra's work was perforce more straightforward, and Meg was not sure how she would respond to talk of a strange dark teacher, 8 or 9 feet tall, and even less sure how she would react to their description of a cherubim. She'd probably insist they were suffering from mass psychosis and that they should all see a psychiatrist at once.
"Or is it just that I'm afraid to talk about it, even to Mother?" Meg wondered as she took sugar, cocoa, milk, and a saucepan from the kitchen and returned to the pantry.
Dr. Calubra was saying, "That stuff about cosmic screams and rips in distant galaxies offends every bit of the rational part of me." Mrs. Murray leaned against the counter. "You didn't believe in Ferandali either until I proved them to you."
"You haven't proven them to me," Dr. Louise said.
"Yet?" She looked slightly ruffled, like a little gray bird. Her short curly hair was gray, her eyes were gray above a small beak of a nose. She wore a gray flannel suit.
"The main reason I think you may be right is that you go to that idiot machine," she pointed at the microelectron microscope, "the way my husband used to go to his violin. It was always like a lover's meeting."
Mrs. Murray turned away from her idiot machine.
"I think I wish I'd never heard of Ferandali, much less come to the conclusions."
She stopped abruptly, then said,
"By the way, kids, I was rather surprised just before you all barged into the lab to have Mr. Jenkins call to suggest that we give Charles Wallace lessons in self-defense."
"Mr. Jenkins?" Meg wondered. Aloud, she said, "But Mr. Jenkins never calls parents. Parents have to go to him." She almost asked, "Are you sure it was Mr. Jenkins?" and stopped herself as she remembered.